Everybody, please open to Daniel chapter 6. And tonight we have, as I mentioned just a moment ago, kind of a more relaxing sort of a night. If you haven't heard the expression Daniel in the lion's den, you know, then what den have you been living in? That is among the most famous of all the chapters in the book of Daniel. It is a relatively easy chapter then to be working with. It is also your last chance to get a deep breath and prepare for the sprint, or the marathon maybe. Now, we will finish the sixth chapter tonight. Certainly, I'm hoping to get a little ways into the seventh even, because chapter seven is the polar opposite. It's one of the most difficult chapters in Scripture. And that because first it's hard, chapter 7, just to sort out what a plethora of visionary parts, you know, visions, represent. And then on top of that, there are expressions used in Daniel 7 that will be found in several other places in Scripture, and most particularly, prominently, in the book of Revelation. So when we hit chapter 7, you have so much interconnectedness, and you realize, you know, we have a handshake going on between the Old Testament and the New Testament right here that requires then not only can the material be a little bit obscure, I guess is the word I use, try to sort out what it actually means, but at the same time, you know, we'll have loads of scriptures that we'll want to be comparing and working with. So if we have any luck here tonight, we'll get through the lion's den, which we all know, and we'll at least get through the vision itself in chapter 7, and then send you home to be thinking about it as we prepare for what will be, you know, a very difficult class next week. So with all of that said, when I do the review, these first six chapters, the first half of the book, are predominantly of a historical nature. Chapter 1 is entirely historical, of course, and the point of that is that Daniel and his friends are demonstrated to be faithful to their God and even superior to their peers. So even though they don't eat the same foods and all of that, they prove themselves physically healthy by maintaining faith to their God and sticking to those dietary requirements of Yahweh. And then also, you know, superior in their intellect and in their behaviors. So early on, 3 years after they've been in captivity, they rise to positions of responsibility in the court of King Nebuchadnezzar. Chapter 2 has a kind of a foundation for the whole rest of the book. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. The dream terrifies him. Nobody can interpret the dream. He's going to kill all the wise men in Babylon because he feels like he needs so desperately to understand it, and they can't prove that they know what they're talking about. And so Daniel is called in, and Daniel interprets the dream as representing five kingdoms. The first four are Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome. There's no question about that whatsoever. But then we have a stone that's cut out without hands, demolishes the statue, grinds it up, it blows away, and then that stone will grow to fill the entire earth. Now, those first four kingdoms, which are of a physical nature and have qualities and characteristics that will not be found in the fifth kingdom, the fifth kingdom, being a spiritual kingdom of a different quality and nature, is vastly superior to these others and will outlast them in both time and influence. It's going to cover the entire planet, of course, as we know so well, for that kingdom is the kingdom of our God and is what we would refer to as Christianity. And then for the first time, not really the first time, I guess, but in such glowing terms in the book, Yahweh, Jehovah, is extolled. You have Nebuchadnezzar giving praise to Daniel and the God who has given Daniel this information. Then in chapter 3, we have this, you know, simple test. Will Daniel's friends still remain faithful when faced with death because they refuse to worship this monstrous statue or the whatever it was, you know, it's very narrow but quite tall thing, not necessarily as this artist suggests in the form of a human being, but whatever this monolithic thing was that they were to worship, they refused to do it. They told the king if they die, that's fine, but God, you know, will make the choice. So into the furnace they go. And once again, we now have Yahweh being extolled. He is glorified. He is identified as being superior to all of the gods because of their faithfulness. Come chapter 4, and here we go again. Nebuchadnezzar has another dream. Nebuchadnezzar is upset again. He sees a big tree that's cut down, iron band around it. You know, what does all this mean? Well, once again, Daniel is demonstrated to be superior to everybody else. He alone can interpret the dream. But he also, in this occasion, has so impressed Nebuchadnezzar that the eternal kingdom now that was extolled and mentioned in the interpretation of chapter 2 comes up again and is praised by Nebuchadnezzar twice in this chapter, only once in chapter 2. And Yahweh himself is praised twice in this chapter as opposed to just once before. And so we have this doubling up of the demonstration that Yahweh is God. Pardon me whilst I cough. Hot air dries everything out. And here I am spouting hot air. So this fourth chapter is fairly straightforward again, and we're getting information on how to interpret dreams, how these things, you know, can represent other truths in world history, which then, of course, brings us to chapter 5. That's a really simple chapter. It's all about one thing. There's a handwriting on the wall, Belshazzar, or Belshazzar, however that was pronounced. He's just a, you know, profane old drunken king, and he's having a big party, but he is so profane and so abominably disrespectful to God that he takes the vessels that had been taken from the temple in Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, and he uses them for just an old, you know, revelrous drinking party. This will cost him his life that night. Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin. And so he's been weighed, he's been measured, he's been found wanting, and Daniel tells him, you're doomed, and sure enough, that's exactly what takes place. So, of course, that brings us now to Daniel 6, brings us up to this point. So far, we have a series of historical events that are all pointing at Jehovah God as superior to the gods of Nebuchadnezzar and his successors. But now, we're going to be looking into chapter 6 and the famous scene with Daniel in the lion's den. So just to tell you in advance, yet again, Daniel will be set above all of his contemporaries and all of his peers and all of his compadres. As powerful, influential, and important as he is in the kingdom, he is always singularly superior to everybody else. He's going to really pay for it this time. God and his kingdom will once again be extolled when all of this is over. Now, something I just want to say very quickly before we go any farther. I have swiped that photograph off the internet, you know, or that painting, or however you want to depict it, because that actually is the title of this movie, and as you can see, that's the advertising for this movie. Now, I don't remember now when this movie came out, 2013. I never heard of it until just a few weeks ago. But it's called The Book of Daniel, and it's by a company now that calls itself PureFlix. Maybe you've noticed that which is referred to as, you know, Christian movies or biblical movies are usually the farthest thing from representing the truth. They're just, you know, crazy wrong. Now, I actually watched a movie one time where Noah spoke to God in the burning bush. Sure enough, it was Noah dealing with the ark, talking to God in a burning bush. Well, that was Moses, not Noah. How far off can you get? But they've been getting better. And one could be hopeful, you know, that they'll continue to get better. And this one, when I watched the advertising, I was really quite surprised. And so I went ahead, I figured I'd roll the dice for $6, you know, and get a copy. So watch the movie. It's just great. It's called The Book of Daniel. And for the first time ever, to a degree at least, that I've never witnessed before, they just tell these same stories that we just went through in the outline, each and every one of these stories, up through chapter 6. But what they do is quote loads of scripture, and the acting has come up to a newer level. You know, in the past, they could be pretty poor, but you got to appreciate people for trying. But this time, they were kind of making it, you know, and you say, wow, that's really pretty well done. And I was surprised at how just moved I was by how well done and hearing all of this scripture. So So I really recommend it. I have a copy right here. First person to rush up after the assembly's over, you can borrow it from me, but I really, really want it back. Feel free. But this at least is really helpful in giving you a little more insight. Now, there's things that are hokey and all that, you know, but anything that can contribute to our kind of sharpening our focus, I think, will be helpful. So give that a shot if you get a chance. So now let's start with Daniel chapter 6, verse 1. It seemed good to Darius, or Darius. Again, nobody's quite sure how to pronounce it. But Darius, let's say, it seemed good to him to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they should be in charge of the whole kingdom. So now, Belshazzar is dead. Darius, king of the Medes and Persians, has taken over, and he decides he's going to set up a new governmental system. And that's not just over his recently conquered territories. But also coincidentally, on Sunday, I was given a copy of this book, and has a son, I think it is, or son-in-law, I'm not sure now, who has access to these. This one is all about history, Book of Kings and Queens. And this Darius is of such importance that when she offered it to me, you know, I took it home and started looking through this thing. It got an introductory section, the first 22 pages. And in that, they've got 10, 12, 15 kings and queens that each get just a corner of a page, you know, a little bit of information. The first time you have a king that gets more than one page, the first one that gets featured and we're really going to talk about him, is Darius the First, this king that we're talking about right here, which is just serves to illustrate that for the umpteen gazillionth time, everything you read in your scriptures are historically accurate. Don't let anybody try to tell you differently. And then also prominent. Nebuchadnezzar is, you know, non-biblical historians' kind of favorite guy, and so is Darius. These are important figures in world history who intersected and interacted with the Lord's people. And so this Darius, as a matter of fact, sets up these satrapies. They mentioned it in this book I just held up. It's from the Encyclopedia Britannica. I grabbed this screenshot. For satrap, the Britannica says, the division of the empire into provinces, which they called satrapies, was completed by Darius I, who reigned from 522 to 486 B.C. Normally, they were members of the royal family or Persian nobility and held office indefinitely. At the head of the administration of his province, the satrap collected taxes and was the supreme judicial authority. He raised and maintained an army to preserve internal security. Top satrap officials and the commander of the troops in each of the provinces were directly responsible to the king. The satrapal administration was retained by Alexander the Great and his successors. Now, we can argue about the dates, and I'm not sure that they've got the dates quite correct here, you know, because everybody's always arguing about dates. Those aren't the ones that I would use. But everything else, you know, about that is certainly the case. And so from now on, as we're reading in Daniel 6, and all the way through the reign of this king, down to the end of the Medo-Persian Empire and into Alexander the Great, this is the superpower's way of organizing things. And so when Darius chooses to do this, we are finding out, he sets up 120 provinces. It's a big kingdom. It's bigger than Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom was, bigger than Babylon's then. And he sets up these 120 provinces. Each one of these rulers is like a governor, and these satraps over these satrapies, they have a lot of responsibility. They're going to have a standing army. They're collecting taxes. They're responsible for the peace of the kingdom. And then those armies used for internal security can certainly be drafted should there be some external threat as well. But as we read now in chapter 6, in verse 2, and over them, three commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them and that the king might not suffer loss. So this is fascinating. How superior has Daniel and his friends established themselves over everybody else throughout 70 years of Babylonian captivity? Everybody knows who these guys are. Royal proclamations have been made in the face of miraculous manifestations that they serve a God who does things that no God the Babylonians ever claimed to have can do. And so here Daniel finds himself one of the highest ranking authorities in the entire Babylonian Empire, and when the king of that empire gets killed by this guy, then you look at the next levels down of the government, and what does this new king decide he's going to do with Daniel? Well, he doesn't replace him with some trusted advisor that he's had for years, you know, in the Medo-Persian Empire. He says, well, okay, Daniel, we'll just keep this going. We'll keep you at the top of the government. And you would think, rather than normal circumstances, most people would say, that's dangerous. You'd have a guy who's lost the empire that he was a high government official in. He's now, therefore, dangerous. He may want to have that new king murdered. He may want to lead some sort of insurrection. He may like the old ways better than the new. That'd be the normal way you'd expect people to react. But with God's hand in this thing, and with Daniel's character so phenomenally well known, you know, they send spies back and forth in these kingdoms all the time, so don't be surprised that Darius would know something about who he's dealing with, you know, when he comes romping into town. He decides he's going to put Daniel as one of three that are over all the governors in the entire empire. Wow! So here's Daniel once again in the throne room with the ear of the king and responsible the highest level of governmental authority. Brings us to verses 3 through 5. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and the satraps, so among the three and the 120, because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. So it doesn't take long now in personal association with Daniel to just see in the man's character and in his life, he's phenomenal. He is just so impressive. You recognize the intelligence, the genius. You recognize the character, his purity. You recognize the faithfulness and the devotion. So loyalty, honor, dignity, purity. These are the things that just radiate from the life of this Daniel, so that foreign, vain, conquering kings will immediately set him over, you know, the kingdom in just short order. Bearing in mind, how old is Daniel then? If Belshazzar dies in 539, Daniel is taken captive in 606, how long has it been? 67 years, and then the kingdom falls, you know, a few more years. He's got to be probably 80 anyway, 90. He is up there. And so when most folks are thinking about Social Security and retirement, what is Darius doing with this doddering old man? He's come on to put you over everything. You're just better than everybody else. And so there isn't anybody else that I could do, you know, better than you. You're it. You're going to be the man. And everybody knows it. So in 3, he is distinguished among the commissioners and satraps, possessing an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. Then the commissioners and the satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation. A ground of accusation against England regarding government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Now, you know, we would laugh about this, and brethren, I'd like to think there might be, you know, one, but if you were going to line up everybody in the United States governmental system and look for a ground of accusation, could you likely find one? Some mistake, some dumb mistake maybe, but, you know, in most cases, some corruption. You know, it wouldn't be hard to find it in most of them. And here's this man, 80 plus, 90 years old, and nobody can think of a single thing that they could say. He was faithful. There's no negligence or corruption to be found in him. So in 5, then these men said, we shall not find any ground of accusation. That's the third time that phrase is used. Against this Daniel, unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. Now what did they realize? He serves Darius flawlessly, and it is impossible to impugn that man's behavior in the exercise of his duties as one of the three commissioners over all of this nation. We'll never find it in his character or in his government responsibility. So we're going to get it. How are we going to get it? We've got to set up a conflict between his God and ours. We've got to set up a conflict between his religion and ours. We're going to have to set up a conflict at the end of verse 5 between the law of his God, which we know he'll never violate, and the law of this kingdom, which, of course, he also had never violated. So they're going to have to set one up, an artificial conflict. And brother, for just a minute, I'd like for you to think about, you know, what they just said. If that was carved on a headstone, you know, so-and-so, we could not find any ground of accusation against this man. Wouldn't that be quite the tribute? As long as it was the truth. Let's just hope one of these days Donna can carve that in my stone, you know. We could not find any ground of accusation against this man and carry my name, your name. There's something to strive for. There's a goal to set, to so conduct your affairs that you know if the most strenuous scrutinizing of the nooks and crannies of your life was ever undertaken by the most powerful people in the country, they could come up with no better statement than we cannot find any ground of accusation against this man. Unless, woman, of course, unless what? Yeah, and that's even higher tribute, isn't it? That's going to be it. We'll hang him that way. So the conspiracy begins. Let's read verses 6 through 15. These commissioners and satraps came by agreement, so they're plotting, to the king. They spoke to him as follows: King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, whatever else might be said about the genius of setting up the kingdom the way he did, he gets, you know, extra pages in a book like this because Darius is a notable ruler, a smart guy when it comes to governmental affairs. What do you learn about his character right here in verse 7? There are, you know, inferences here that are pretty obvious. He's got to be some kind of arrogant, doesn't he? That he could fall for this. Yeah, that's a good idea. Nobody can pray to a god or a man before me. 30 days. Okay? So there's a flaw. And now in 8, now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. You're all familiar with that. They're real proud of that. Nicolai can't change it. Now that's dumb. Okay? So we're all, you know, committing the Medes and the Persians here to say that you could never make a mistake, and so if you utter an edict, it could never be reversed, is also arrogant but foolish. You know, that's nobody's advocate. So in 9, therefore, King Darius, so he signed the document. That is the injunction. Now when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he's a pretty high-ranking guy. He wasn't party to these negotiations. So even if he was able to try and argue against it, he would have failed, or else he just didn't know. But when he finds out, he entered his house, and in his room chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. He continued kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. And who knew it? Those other commissioners, for sure. Apparently a bunch of those satraps too would also, people would remember at the day, you know, of our internment, that this was a person whose prayer life was renowned. In 11 then, these men came by agreement, found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. Somehow they spied on him from another window, they broke in, I don't know what they did, but, you know, they pounced. 12, then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? The king answered and said, the statement is true, according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which may not be revoked. Then they answered and spoke before the king. Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, see how they want to paint him negatively, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition 3 times a day. Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed. Was he enraged like Nebuchadnezzar? Wow, this is a whole different response. And he set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. I can imagine all the wise men in the kingdom are being called in again. And this time, it's to save Daniel. But he can't do it. 15, these men came by agreement to the king. They said to the king, recognize, O king, that this is a law of the Medes and Persians, that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed. Now, they're sure overplaying their hands, and it looks to me like, really, right here, that's not a bright move. To come in and push on a king like that, who's working so hard that this not happen, even if you're right, put you crossways with him, it's going to make him mad. And so I'm not so sure that these guys were all the brightest that, you know, the world ever produced, but they really want Daniel killed. So in 16, the king gave orders. Daniel was brought in. He was cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. And a stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet rings of the nobles, that nothing might be changed in regard to Daniel. And the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting. No entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. And then the king arose with the dawn at the break of day and went in haste to the lion's den. And when he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions? Now, I chose you to see on the screen to read verses 16 through 20 and just to use the title, The King's Hope, because that's what's portrayed in verse 16. Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you. And that's how it's portrayed in 20. Now, again, in this case, Daniel will have only had a year or two or three to establish himself in this king's mind. The preceding 67 years, you know, they all understood the stories about David interpreting dreams, or Daniel rather, interpreting dreams, and then friends coming out of the fiery furnace and all this. Do these stories just get erased? No, they're remembered. They're passed on down. And Darius is apparently familiar with these. He also will have spent a lot of time talking to Daniel. He gets this Daniel. And he respects this Daniel enough that he's not messing with Daniel's God. Now he's been caught because of it. But he's beginning and ending this night praising the God of heaven and hoping that that God, knowing his own God can't do it, would save Daniel. There he is. That mock mentality, I guess you call it, but it's peer pressure, isn't it? I mean, these guys are all below this king, but what Mariana's saying is just so extremely valid. You know, we have this expression, go with the flow. Is that considered a negative thing or a positive thing? Is that good advice or bad advice? Go with the flow. You know, every time I hear it, somebody suggests that's a good thing. Did Daniel or his friends ever go with the flow? Oh, the river was against them. So as Marianne is pointing out, you know, the king, he's all for that. He's going with the flow, all my state traps, you know, and these commissioners. But it catches him. So he's hopeful, and of course he's rewarded. So Daniel's vindicated in verse 21 through 24. Daniel responded. He spoke to the king. O king, live forever. Now, at this point, he's probably considerably older than the king is. I'm a little humorous anyway. O king, you live forever. I'm down here in Lion's Den, 80, 90 years old. But my God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth. They have not harmed me, inasmuch as I was found innocent before him. And also towards you, O king, I have committed no crime. And then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him because he had trusted in his God. A little while ago we heard that Karen Crawford tripped and hit a wall, got some skin, you know, knee or some such. She's in worse shape right now than Daniel was. After he spent a night with the lions, he's got nothing on him. So in 24, the king then gave orders. They brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel. They cast them and their children and their wives into the lion's den. They had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. So it wasn't that these lions were sick. It wasn't that they were sated because somebody had been feeding them big pork chops. You know, they were hungry. They were mean. And they were ready for these guys. But God had miraculously saved Daniel. So, let me point out again, if you do decide to rent, borrow, you know, buy, whatever you're going to do with this movie from PureFlix, it's called The Book of Daniel, that particular scene I thought was a little bit weak. Please don't think, you know, that I'm putting this movie up for an Academy Award. But, you know, better than most, you know, and it was interesting to just have it acted out and scripture then being quoted. But, you know, however this event took place, whatever the shape and depth and, you know, and dens, dimensions and all the rest of that, those lions made their point. And that was the end of the conspirators. And the proof that Daniel is a man of the God who alone can do these things. If you're a regular member here, you know we've had four or five lessons now on miracles on Sunday mornings in the Bible class. We'll be taking Daniel up come Sunday, because we do have this series of miracles that are taking place in this particular time frame. So we'll be talking about that just this very next Sunday, coincidentally. Okay, so Daniel is vindicated, and we're going to close out the chapter with verses now 25 through 28. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and languages who were living in all the land. May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and enduring forever, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. So coming down throughout all of that. Now, you remember last time in class, I pointed out that I've picked a couple of colors to highlight in my Bible these statements, because the more I'm looking at the book, you know, I'm realizing there are themes that are being developed. So in yellow, you know, I've marked this in Daniel chapter 2. He'll set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed. That kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. And I turn the page and I go to chapter 4 and verse 3, the second half. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion is from generation to generation. I turn another page in chapter 4 and I read the last part of verse 34. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom endures from generation to generation. And now we get to chapter 6 and verse 26, and again in the last half of that verse, his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. His dominion will be forever. Where are Nebuchadnezzar and now Darius getting the information that the kingdom of Yahweh is forever? Getting it from Daniel and their friends in conversations with them, no one can fault their government. If we're going to have grounds for accusation, it'll have to be in his spiritual relationships. Well, that's because he makes those relationships known. Brethren, be the light of the world. Be the light of the world. Whatever you're doing, people should know every day, every way. You're different. You're better. You're a Christian. You're a follower of this book that we call the Bible. So, Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian, and thus ends the historical first half of the book of Daniel. Comments or questions? Any of those first six chapters? Where are you at? It's relatively easy. We get these dreams, we get these interpretations, but they're also fairly easy to understand. And so, the going is not tough in the first half. It's about to get there. Cal, I couldn't quite tell. Did you have a hand up? You were pointing at somebody else. No. Yeah, Jimmy's mentioning what is very troublesome, to all of us, and you see this time and again. Soldiers die because Jesus is raised from the dead and comes out of the tomb and that sort of thing, and so we naturally think, well, that's just unfair. They didn't do that. They just drew a bad duty that night. Why should they have to die? And let alone a circumstance like this, whole family, kids and all tossed in here with these lions. It is troublesome. But God also is working in and through the existing governments, and nations. So he's made his point, but Darius is going to have to answer for that too. That's not to say that what he does should be thought of as being upright and holy and pure. We can't pass a judgment on it. It's just stated as a fact, and so we'll have to leave it there. But everyone has to account. For instance, you think about trials that Jesus goes through, and the washing of hands, and all that kind of thing. These people are not able to exonerate themselves. They're responsible. But had Pilate set Jesus free, kind of throws a monkey wrench in everything. So, what did you want? He'd say, okay, I'm turning him loose. Well, he would have had to die somehow. And it was going to be because of evil. So we just, like you said, have to accept God knows and God's in control, but God's also the judge, and that's just the most important part of this. We'll leave that, to him then, and how that's going to work out. It's also not his fault. He shouldn't be charged with it. Okay, so with that under our belts, let's come back now to Daniel and chapter 7. As I said, I was hopeful exactly this. We would take the first three quarters of our hour, deal with chapter 6, and then set the stage, a very difficult stage, a very complicated and elaborate stage for next week's interpretation. So let's see if we can get through these first 15 verses in chapter 7 just to make sure that we've got the component parts. Now, I didn't actually count, but I had one of those nights last night. I fell asleep early. I woke up at 2 o'clock in the morning. I spent the next 3 hours studying Daniel 7. I have been studying Daniel 7 with great fear and trepidation for several weeks now. I can understand these first six chapters, they're not tough, but I knew there was a seventh chapter down the road there somewhere, and so that's what I've been focusing on, in addition to all these other studies. So there I was, this morning working my way down through chapter 7. So I got myself in, your typical yellow legal notepad, and I started a column in the left-hand side there that was just to identify every single component part of what we're about to read. And then I was hoping to just make a chart and start collecting from all my various resources what are possible explanations for each of these things. I wish I'd have thought to count. I just didn't. But it took me 2 pages. To write on each line. Every line is filled with just one statement from what we're about to read. It is the elaborate nature of chapter 7 that makes it particularly difficult. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. How many component parts does it have? It's got four parts. The fourth part, though, is a mixture, clay, and iron. And then we got a rock. So you either say there's four, or you could call it 4A and B, or call it five, and then we got a rock. Okay? Now, how difficult is that? I filled two pages, every single line, getting this list. Bill, did you have your hand up there? No, okay. All right, so we're just going to read through this and set the stage, as I said. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, this is struggle for us because of these co-regencies where fathers and son ruled together. So there's about a four-year spread here. Homer Haley would suggest this is 549 B.C. Others say 553, as we saw in the chart with Encyclopedia Britannica. We don't know for sure, but it's somewhere there at least, right at 550, one side or the other, of 550 B.C. Daniel this time has a dream and visions in his mind on his bed. Then he wrote the dream down and related the summary of it, which is this to follow. Verse 2, Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, so here is the first line on my notepad, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Line 2, great sea. 3, verse 3, four great beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. I didn't put a line for that because I knew I'd get a line for each of the four beasts. So the third thing I put was, verse 4, the first was like a lion. So I put lion. Had wings of an eagle. Next line, wings of eagle. I kept looking until its wings were plucked. Next line, plucked. And it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. In a human mind, also was given to it. So in verse 4, I've been scouring the internet, and I've seen a lot of really lousy artist illustrations, and none of them are going to come close to it anyway. Here's one that I find. What he sees first is readily recognizable as a lion. It's a lion in every sense except one. What's that? Well, really, let's say two. But the one is, it has the wings of an eagle. So that has never been seen before. It's also, if you want to call this a second difference, coming up out of the sea. Lions can swim, but they don't spend a whole lot of time, swimming in the ocean. And so it is, that's odd. So the four winds are chewing up the ocean, a body of water. And up out of it now comes this lion with the wings of an eagle. Then he becomes more lion-like because the wings are removed. It says plucked. One wonders if it's violent and bloody and what this looks like. But they're taken off, and then he's raised up like a man. So he gets up on his hind legs, becomes bipedal like you and I are. And so he then is also given a human mind. So now somehow we recognize this lion is not just an animal. It thinks like a human being. It could have a name like Fred, because now it thinks like a human. The body's different for a man, but it's become a man, is the point that we're trying to portray. So there's our lion. This brings us then to the next verse in chapter 7 and verse 5. Behold, another beast, a second one, resembling a bear, and was raised up on one side. Now, the best this guy does, he gives it the hunchback of Notre Dame look over on one side. We don't know what that means. It's raised up on one side, and nobody's ever going to be able to figure that out. I don't get what that is. One leg longer than the other on that side. He just put his foot up on a rock. Who knows? We don't need to know, or would have been told. But somehow this bear is raised up on one side. He's got three ribs in his mouth between his teeth. Now, bears are carnivores, not solely, but they eat meat. And so for a bear to have ribs in his mouth is something that's natural and normal to a bear. But
What does it represent?
Why three? Why not seven? You know, 16? What? And thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. Well, thus they said, arise and devour much meat. So the idea is, go fill your mouth with more ribs than anything else you want. You know, go out, kill and eat, or be, you know, a scavenger. I don't know how it works, but this animal is associated with eating meat. So, fine. Then comes verse 6. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one, therefore another beast, like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. These wings are different, though. They're not said to be like an eagle. I suspect if they were just like the other wings, we've been told so. So they're like some other kind of a bird. And the beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. Well, that last statement is the kind of thing that I think maybe we're getting used to with Daniel. In that, as we're looking at these visions and hearing, you know, the descriptions of these dreams, it occurs to me that in addition to just what is seen, that emotions are also thrust upon the viewer. So you say dominion was given. Well, how do you portray that? So I don't know, but somehow Daniel understands it's a ruler. It's somehow powerful in authority. Dominion is when you dominate, when you rule, when you control, when you have power over, when your way and say goes, and the other person or whatever, you know, just has to respond. I don't know how you portray that. We're not told. He just got it. It's just like additional information that's given to him. So here in this, the sixth verse, there's a leopard-like thing, but for the four wings and the four heads and the dominion. Now, seven. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful, terrifying, extremely strong. It had large iron teeth. It devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. It was different from all the beasts that were before it. And it had 10 horns. Now, I've seen lots of really, you know, funky kinds of pictures here. You know, most of them look like dinosaurs, Stegosaurus, T-Rex. I've seen them all with 10 horns on their head, you know, when you go looking for the photos. As a matter of fact, I kind of painted it out of here, artfully, I might add. But down at the bottom down here, there's a whole lot of Chinese characters. So originally, this, you know, was drawn by some guy in China, I guess. So, you know, we don't know what it looked like, but it was dreadful. It was terrifying. So just to see it, you know, would make you tremble. And whatever this powerful, monstrous thing is, coming out of the sea again, like the others, you know, it's got these 10 horns with iron teeth. I think iron, but that looks like ivory to me. At any rate, you know, here's this, what's that? So, you know, the first thing you say, well, what's it like? Does he tell you? Well, what's the first one like? A lion. Well, what's the second one like? What's the third one like? Bears and leopards. Well, okay, those are recognizable. Is this recognizable as anything anybody's ever seen? See, apparently not. So highly unusual, and it's declared to be different, and it has these 10 horns. Now comes verse 8. Now I laugh every time I see this one. But while I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. And behold, this horn possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great. Boast is a supplied word, but whatever it was, you know, some kind of impressive great statement. So I guess that works as well, you know, as anything else. It is real notable. This one makes it bigger than the other horns. Well, it's described, you know, the other way as being little, but nonetheless, you know, what's that? I mean, immediately, you know, what in the world? And then comes 9 and 10. It's just shocking, you know, no transition, is just jarring. We get this different thing. I kept looking, So there's continuity until thrones were set up and the Ancient of Days took seat. His vesture like white snow, hair of his head like pure wool, his throne ablaze with flames, its wheels burning fire. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him. Myriads upon myriads were standing before him. The court sat, and the books were opened. Then I kept looking because of the sound of... And I knew that second one was coming. I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. Well, somehow they're interrupting the show. They're so prominent. I kept looking until the beast was slain, its body was destroyed, and given to the burning fire. As for the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. He came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and languages might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away. His kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. Highlighted in yellow in my Bible, because we've just seen that several times. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. So next week, keep reading this. Keep thinking about this. Keep asking yourself, where have I seen some of these elements in other places in Scripture? And then finish the chapter, because there'll be even more. Things that are in Daniel and things that are in Revelation, you know, it just keeps getting worse even as we get the interpretation. So next week, we'll spend all our time on the interpretation. What is the lion? What is the bear? What is this four-headed leopard? What is that monster? What is that little horn? And what is this Ancient of Days, Son of Man, and Eternal Kingdom? Sayonara.